Wow. Hello. Thank you, Vesica. Actually, I was thinking this morning about how to prepare myself, and I went for a run. I thought, oh, well, that'll be enough energy, but grounded enough. And as I was running, I thought, oh, yeah, this probably is a talk about virya. And it probably is a talk about momentum. It probably is a talk about what happens when you meet something that opens a doorway for you. And since we're in a nice, hot environment, which is lovely for me and I'm sure some other people, it feels like we can talk about the what happens when you open the doorway to the breeze of liberation, to the cooling winds of liberation. So I suppose... So I was just curious to see how you introduced me. I was like, oh, okay. That adds up. So if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about my own experience of opening the doorway, if you like. When I first came across the Tri Ratna Sangha, it literally blew me away. I'd been quite a lot like Tibor. Where's he gone? Somewhere. There we go. I'd read everything I could find about Buddhism when I was a teenager. It really, really inspired me. But I didn't know any Buddhists until I was 24. And in my 20s, I hung out with every Buddhist group I could find just because I really wanted to. So I hung out with Theravadins and Kagyus and Shambhalans and all sorts. But something else happened when I was 31. I came across a Tri Ratna thing for the first time, which was at Rivendell. And I'd found something that I'd never encountered before. And for me, what I found there is at the heart of what the Sangha is about. So there was friendliness and there was interest. I'm sure you all recognize that experience of coming into a friendly, interested place. I was encouraged to tell the truth and to get to know what was actually happening in my own experience rather than what I thought I should be thinking or feeling or doing. And there was so much kindness, and it was a kindness that felt like it was really for my development. And it was a kindness that in that moment needed absolutely nothing in return. I love the fact that the conversations I was in moved so fluently between inner worlds, dreamscapes, what it was like to be a body in meditation, heart longing, and what was going on in the world and the nature of things. And I loved the fact that we could move between those kinds of conversations and making porridge and washing up with equal ease. I found it incredibly hopeful that people were talking about their practice by showing what was actually going on in their mental states, seemingly without guilt, but with a real sense of being able to kind of work with what it was that they were finding in their own mental states. And I'd never encountered somewhere or a place where people were so genuinely and deeply appreciative of each other. And over time, I've seen that people become more themselves rather than less themselves, the more that they practice. I'd studied Buddhism at university because that was the place where I could find some contact with it. And I'd read everything I could possibly imagine and practiced with all of these other groups. But I'd never really seen in a direct and tangible and psychologically astute and contemporary way what Buddhist practice actually looked like. And when I saw it, I knew that's what I wanted to be. That's what I wanted to do. So the fact that these particular things struck me so forcibly probably says quite a lot about my own kind of conditioning and the kind of world that I grew up in, which was deeply distorted and very tangled with half-truths, untruths, hatred, kind of emotional repression. So that meeting something that showed what was really going on and could meet what was really going on was a lifesaver for me. And I feel like that practicing in this context has personally given me meaning. It's given me dignity. And it's radically changed my life, as you may have heard from that introduction. Pretty much nothing stands the way it stood when I met the Dharma in Sri Ratna. I've moved across the world. I've changed almost everything of how I do things, and what I do, and how I live because of it. The only thing that hasn't changed is my height, but I'm still sure if I practice long enough, I'll get taller. And in a way, like, all of those things have changed, not because anybody said, oh, you should do something else. They've changed because I fell in love with the Dharma. I fell in love with the Sangha. And I've been fascinated by it, and I want to be part of it, and I want to belong to it, and I want to contribute to it. And that's really all there is to it. So I want to talk today a little bit about what kind of... So that was the difference, in a way, that made a difference to me. And I want to talk today about what kind of difference that difference makes in the world. And I apologize to all translators. So what kind of difference does it make that we can live and practice like this? So I'll talk about two dimensions of that. The one is what I'm calling the Sangha as Dharma, which I think is quite unique to what we do in Sri Ratna, practicing the Sangha as a practice of Dharma. And the other is a set of principles and forms that we've created together that offers something to the world, offers refuge, offers models, offers meaning, offers ways of making progress. And I'll do a little bit of, because I'm in the UK now, I'll do a little bit of Sangha health and safety as well. So let me start with the practice of Sangha as the Dharma. You probably know there are very many beautiful accounts in the Pali Canon, the oldest sources that we have, about friendship and what is often called association with the wise. It's given an extremely high value. And you may have heard about a conversation between Ananda and the Buddha. Ananda was his companion and assistant. And Ananda, very inspired one day, went to the Buddha and he said, friendship is so important. It's like half of the holy life. And the Buddha said, don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. It's actually the whole of the holy life. For one who has admirable friends develops and pursues the Noble Eightfold Path. And in a way, I think this is what Pranyaketu was pointing to about the looking up and the growing up. So, but how does friendship with admirable people help? You make progress, the Buddha says, by emulating them and learning their good qualities. In the Sambodhi Sutta, the Buddha says that having admirable companions, friends, and comrades is the first prerequisite for the development of the wings to self-awakening. It's the first prerequisite for the development of the wings to self-awakening. In the chapter of ones in the Atuvitaka, the Buddha says, I don't envisage any other single factor like admirable friendship, as doing so much for a monk in training who has not yet attained the heart's goal, but remains intent on the unsurpassed safety from bondage. Can't imagine anything else as important for someone who is on the path and pursuing liberation as friendship with admirable people. Because a friend with admirable people abandons what is unskillful and develops what is skillful. So we have 50 years of collective practice here in the movement and in the order. And many in the Sangha are admirable, far ahead on the path and worthy of following. They are indeed treasures, admirable friends around whom we can abandon what is unskillful and develop what is skillful. And I'm sure that you can all think of a few people in your own lives who have embodied the Dharma, who communicate the Dharma, who are admirable friends to you and who have helped you to develop as a person. So one of the things that the Sangha can and does offer the world, if we can go for a watery metaphor, is this reservoir of skillfulness and wisdom. A reservoir of virtue, even. Speaking of these lovely old-fashioned words, I like the word virtue. And it's not only a reservoir of individual people or qualities, it's also a collective way of doing things. A culture of skillful means, working together in groups, celebrating each other's positive qualities, seeing and naming each other's potential. Mitra study, rituals, leading retreats. In so many ways, we are inheritors of this collective wisdom of 50 years of combined practice, and we're continuing to learn and develop and spread that out all of the time. So leading retreats and classes draws on these qualities, but it's not the only contribution of this reservoir of skillfulness and wisdom. There are so many people here, just looking around, friends, mitras, order members, whose work and roles in the world as carers, as musicians, as poets, as activists, as parents, mindfulness teachers, ecologists, writers, commentators, nurses, all sorts of beautiful things, all sorts of altruistic work are fed and feed into that reservoir of wisdom. And they're all communicating the Dharma. And it is really important that we remember that it's not us as personalities who are participating in this way. We are all inheritors of the Dharma, and in as much as we're acting from wisdom, we're acting in the lineage of the Buddhas. The Ratnaguna Samchayagata says, "For whatever the Jinnas have taught, the conquerors, those who have conquered greed, hatred, and delusion, the guide to the Dharma, their pupils, if genuine, have been well trained in it, and from direct experience, derived from their training, they teach it. And their teaching stems from the might of the Buddhas and not their own power." Okay, so the Sangha is the Dharma to the degree that we individually and collectively are living this gathering of wisdom and acting more and more in accord with the way that things really are. And friendship is central to this adventure. It is an adventure, this adventure of the spiritual life. So in the canon, going back to the Pali canon, you get a glimpse into how living together in harmony might have looked out like at the time of the Buddha, as it did, for example, with the three clansmen, Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila. The Buddha asked, "How are you getting on together, living and practicing in seclusion?" And Anuruddha said, "They were living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, and viewing each other with kindly eyes." I really love that, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And how were they able to do that? They lived, Anuruddha said, with bodily acts of loving kindness, both openly and privately. With verbal acts of loving kindness, both openly and privately. And with mental acts of loving kindness, both openly and privately. And it wasn't just a pleasant way of living. It was the foundation of their practice together. Dwelling diligent, ardent, and resolute, it says, they could abide in the dhyanas, in these refined mental states, secluded from unwholesome states, their taints destroyed by their seeing and wisdom. So we do have some glimpses, if you like, of an ideal of the best possible Sangha life that was lived and the kinds of collaboration that that involved. Actually, we also have glimpses into the worst kind of things that went on in the Sangha, in the Vinaya, or the case law. But either way, most traditional accounts are of full-time monastic life. And I'm assuming, since you're here, that most of you don't want to become monks or nuns. Even if you are Anagarikas or practicing Brahmacharya, you are wanting to lead a different kind of life. So how do we live and practice together in that way, in today's conditions? And of course, the Dharma is rich in methods. It is abundant in all three divisions of ethics and meditation and wisdom. But what Sangharachita has given us is other doorways, another doorway into the truths of the Buddha's teachings, and an extension of the truths and practices into the kind of world that we live in today, dominated by Western paradigms of knowledge, increasing sort of social alienation, mediation by screens. He's initiated means and contexts for traversing the Buddhist path. Right now, we can all walk the Buddhist path that both supplement the traditional practices and also open new gateways, new doorways to insight and the cultivation of compassion. He's added arts and aesthetics as a path, and Sangha as friendship and a path. So this gives a kind of contemporary psychology, a sort of process-oriented approach to the more traditional goals that we see laid out in the traditional texts. So not only do we know what it might look like at the end of the road, but we're also given a context and tools for walking that road ourselves. So the notion of the true individual, ideas about group and spiritual community, creative and reactive mind, the system of practice, all of these are Dharma and Sangha woven together. And all of the dimensions of that, how we become more whole, how we become more positive, how we see through our views, how we become more, how we open the doorways to the beyond, all of that has relational elements in it. All of that is done in friendship and in community. We become more whole, we could even say more naked, in becoming increasingly seen and witnessed, transparent. The emphasis on positive emotion and the widespread practice of the Metta Bhavana is unique to Triratna. I'd gone through all of that reading of Dharma books and all of those groups, and I'd never done the Metta Bhava until I was 31, even though it's completely foundational to how we practice, and it shows in how we are with each other. The emphasis on pleasure and beauty as a fundamental part of our spiritual life counteracts nihilism. So does allowing the world to touch us, giving us permission to care and to take responsibility and to know that all our actions have consequences. All of these make a huge difference to the nature of the community that we're part of. The teachings of Pratityasamutpada help us to understand and work through our conditioned views and the forms of experience that they lead to. Through confession and ways of working with our assumptions and preferences and profoundly limiting views of ourselves and others, we can understand our personal conditioning and see through those views that aren't true, aren't helpful. And increasingly, we're also looking more at our social conditioning around gender, around race, around rank, around economics, and looking at how we can open up those views that limit ourselves and others, and also basically are doing enormous damage to the environment. So our friendships and our communication, our communities, support the intimate, lovely, and difficult work of growing up. Developing into and through relationships and community is a very much big part of our practice, as well as meditation, ritual, reflection on the nature of existence. And Sangharakshita's focus on becoming a true individual builds freedom for self-development right into the heart of what we're doing. And unlike many of the more traditional forms of Buddhism, we're all encouraged, each one of us, not just encouraged, we're asked to take responsibility for studying and understanding what we're doing. That's why we do Mitra study. And think about things and think them through for ourselves. We're taught to recognize the group in our own response and to support the development of others. Of course, we don't always do these things, but we do have the tools available to us. And in our training, confession and ethical practice is linked directly to insight. We're trained to recognize the skillfulness of our actions in relation to the precepts, to look at the mental states behind our actions and what conditions them, and then look at the views that give momentum or give energy, give force to how it is that we're acting in the world. So right here, right now, in the tone of the voice, in how you hold your body, in the stories we tell ourselves, in how we feel when we act, each one of those is a doorway to insight. And our contemporary kind of life is so fascinated by experience, right? We're so kind of interested in our own experience, but it's very, very hard to know what to do with that experience without training. And we offer a training in that. And these teachings put the dual imperatives of freedom and relationship at the very heart of what we do together, both as a means of development and as an end in itself. Okay, so here's the health and safety bit. I said earlier on that the work of growing up together is intimate and beautiful and difficult. And it's important, I think, to understand what it is that we're doing here. And coming along to the Sangha, many of us have heard over the last few days, we're often struck by a kind of level of skillfulness, non-competition, inclusion, that we may never, ever have encountered in our lives before. It can be easy to think that all of our experiences of the Sangha will be pleasant and positive. They are. So I'm just going to do this about my own experience, really. For myself, I've noticed that when I go through a doorway, maybe let me say what I mean by going through a doorway. Often there might be something new that comes up in me that I've not experienced before, or I realize that I've been doing something that I try and open up and put aside. And it's a bit like opening a doorway to a breeze, and the tight and restrictive clothing of my previous life falls away, and you walk into a new landscape that you've never seen before. And there you are, a bit naked, but cool, in the new liberation. And now what are you going to do? So when I notice that when that happens, and it happens regularly, if you practice, this will happen regularly to you, that sometimes I can get a bit afraid that I've gone off the edges of my own map and I don't know what's going on. So I've developed a little mental checklist for myself, which I will offer to you in great embarrassment. So I usually know when I'm in this territory, when I feel like I'm not sure what is going on. And my own conditioning is to be very, very sure about what's going on. So often I find that quite bewildering. And although I know and I trust that whatever happening is positive, I can get a bit panicked. And if I get panicked, usually that's not very good. But it's part of the practice. It's part of the practice. Or I'm trying out something new. I've never been this way before. Speaking in public. Actually, I have done that before. But, you know, you try something new and it's really clunky. It's a bit like suddenly you're a grown-up and then you develop this whole adolescent arm that's not quite yet in control of itself. Yeah? It can be really, really clunky. And it's a bit like you haven't quite integrated that part of yourself yet. So that can have an effect on yourself or others. This is the really embarrassing bit. Or else I end up having a huge crush on somebody. And I think what happens is there's a new being, a new dimension of myself that is out in the world and it's looking to be met. But in a way, it can only be met in the world of fantasy because it's not yet integrated enough to properly be in an adult relationship with others. So that's even when good things are going on. And I also know that I've changed in ways that have disappointed people who love me. Yeah. So you heard that I've basically left a number of things in order to be doing this, and that wasn't pleasing to some of the people that I care very deeply about. Yeah. So that can also happen. And I certainly know that my own clumsiness has bruised some of my friendships, and I certainly know that I've been on the receiving end of some slightly clunky views and actions also. And as we make progress, we can come up against ever more subtle and entrenched wrong views, biases, numbness, ignorance, self-clinging, and less socially acceptable forms of hatred and delusion. And blind spots really are blind spots. Blind spots really are blind spots. So there you have it, a couple of things to watch out for. So if you spot intoxication, if you spot that you or others around you are being carried away, are feeling drunk with enthusiasm for whatever new idea or bit of dharma or practice that they have found, it probably means that you or others have lost some kind of connection with what's going on for somebody else. So watch out for your intoxication. And if you find yourself thinking that the Sangha will provide stable security, like you can let go somehow of yourself because now you're in the Sangha and the Sangha will take care of you at that level, you're probably in the realm of utopian thinking. It's probably not going to provide the kind of deep-rooted social or personal security that you may be looking for in that, and that's going to come crashing at some time. So look after yourself and look after your friends as much as you can, and keep your awareness as open as possible in the midst of your enthusiasm for Sangha life and your love for the Dharma. Which is not to say don't fall in love with the Dharma. Fall in love with the Dharma. Find the doorways. Open the doorway. Walk through. Yeah. So, just thinking about what we've heard over the last few days, time and time again, we've seen how encounters with the Dharma and encounters with the Sangha in particular have radically altered somebody's existential condition. So coming into the Sangha is not just about finding new friends or entertainment, although there's lots of that also. It's about actually radically altering the existential conditions for one another. Literally, life courses, histories, forms of education, we've heard all of those. The possibility of a life with integrity and dignity, we've heard those. The possibility of being able to do something that can offer something to the world, which in a way is one of the things that we all most want and need. It supports people who are doing all sorts of altruistic activity. It opens doors. It opens doors. I want to go back to a little bit of what Vasika was talking about last night. I'm really pleased you raised some of those talks and writings that Bhante did in the 1970s about the world. In a way, this is part of the question, what can the Sangha offer the world? And he had that short essay in what is the Sangha called a Buddhist view of current world problems. And I want to go over that list that Yashodeva, you read out in your reading last night. He offers, Sangharakshita offered, a four-step recipe for a response for the world. So the first is self-development. Develop your mind, develop your emotional positivity, look after yourself so that you can be of help to others. The second, join a spiritual community. Get in contact with admirable people wherever you find them. Third, withdraw support from all groups or agencies that discourage directly or indirectly the development of individuals. So weaken the network of greed and hatred and delusion by pulling the plug on it whenever you can. Withdraw your support. And fourth, encourage the development of individuality within all the groups to which you unavoidably belong. Stand up for what you believe in. Act in accordance with your ideals. For a long time, maybe this is one of the root questions of my own spiritual life. For a long time, the question for me has been, is that enough? Yeah. Is the Dharma enough? Is the Dharma adequate to the nature of the world that we live in? Is the Sangha adequate to the nature, to the suffering of the world? And partly that question for me is motivated by the fact that I grew up in a highly politicized environment. And rightly so. And rightly so. But politics seemed to me, politics I was taught, was the answer to the question of how to address suffering in the world. And politics of a very specific form. So I was taught this really crazy idea that I should save the world. Have you seen the world? But that's what I was taught. Like, I should grow up to save the world somehow. And in a way, the whole of the outward-facing dimension of my practice has been about really trying to think through that question of whether that's the right, whether that's right, whether that's possible. And I've come to the conclusion that there are two mistakes in trying to save the world. The one is that on my own, somehow, I can ever be adequate to address the incredible networks of greed and hatred and entanglement, the institutionalization of greed and hatred and entanglement, the suffering far and near. Yeah, it's impossible. And to ask that of any one of us in a literal way is really not very kind or very helpful. And the second thing I've realized about the imperative to save the world is that it's usually implied that somehow you have to be separate from and against the world. To save the world is somehow to hate a certain thing and to find effective ways of eradicating it such that it no longer disturbs the world. And I don't think either of those things are either true or helpful. So I think that nothing any one of us can do individually, now, here, with any of the means that we have at our disposal, is adequate to the nature of the suffering of the world, which is why we become bodhisattvas. Because it is quite literally an impossible task and the only one worth doing. And what bodhisattvas do is they make worlds. They don't destroy worlds, they make worlds. The Sangha becomes Avalokiteshvara once it's broken, once it's stopped a certain kind of heroism. It becomes collective. It becomes multiple. It becomes thousand arms. It recognizes all the doorways to the Dharma that are not the same doorway for me and the same doorway for you. We build these networks of awakening, these networks of activity without givers and receivers, and this is what we can offer the world. We can make new worlds, and we can invite other people to participate in those worlds, and we can show people what kinds of worlds are possible. But how? How? So our lives today, our contemporary sort of lives, usually involve smaller households, fewer direct means of engaging with one another. We're often very busy. We're highly stimulated. A lot of our worlds are mediated by screens. Quality of our work is decreasing, more inequality, and a lot of meaninglessness. So what Arthur Kusselin was saying yesterday about the barbecue, and a life that for which that's the only horizon. A lot of us live with that. But it's not all decline. 100 years ago, if we were all here now, most of the places that we came from would have been in the midst of a really terrible world war. Yeah? So I think that sort of story that everything now is worse than ever, as Pranyaketi was saying, is not a very helpful story. But the forms of suffering do change. And I think that what we have in Buddhism is particularly useful for the forms of suffering that we see. And there's a lot of suffering at the moment directly related to mental states and how we work with it and the nature of the mind. Depression, anxiety, self-harm, meaninglessness, all of these things are pretty rampant at the moment. And the Dharma speaks directly to this kind of suffering. And we are damaging the environment, and we are basically undermining the capacity for the conditions for life to flourish on Earth. And I think that the Dharma offers a lot of ways into that question as well. But how can we seriously practice the Dharma now, and what is it that we can do to offer the world? How can we train ourselves to swim upstream against the tides of unskillfulness? So Sangharajita founded this new Buddhist movement and order in a very particular time and place. It was the midst of a cultural revolution in the UK in the 1960s and 1970s, and into experiments with all sorts of new ways of living, new kinds of acid. It was a time where there was a really hearty post-war welfare state and a kind of collectivist project, benefits, squatting, the loaning and rejuvenation of public buildings, a class revolution, post-war greater gender equality, investments in public life, new forms of family life, a sexual revolution, new forms of work. It was pre-AIDS and it was pre-internet. And I wasn't around here then, and I can't quite imagine the arrival of this anachronistic, self-educated, slightly gentlemanly Sangharakshita from India joining and in a way galvanizing this kind of massive social and Dharma revolution. It was a massive experiment. And it was in this mix, this experimental mix, that the sort of Dharma of Sangha was born. And there are a whole lot of ways in which Bhante re-articulated very traditional Buddhist teachings in new forms, with new principles. And this is part of our lineage. It's a very important part of our lineage. So we are neither monastic nor lay, but primarily committed to going for refuge. This is a principle. We have equal ordinations and equal spiritual trainings for men and women. And this is a principle. And it's a principle that now needs to take gender diversity more into account. We engage in collective practice and come together in large and small numbers as we are here this lovely weekend. And that's a principle, that we come together. We share and develop a common language about our practice. We try and practice as intensely as possible, and we enter into regular and meaningful communication about our practice. This is a principle. We also seek to create ethical and principled livelihoods and means to support practice at depth, as well as whole life situations for those people who want to be involved in that and can benefit from it. And that is a principle. And we engage in altruistic activity in the Bodhisattva ideal. That is a principle. It's probably enough to keep going for a while. And these principles were given to us in the 1970s, 1980s, and the resulting lifestyles and forms have given context and weight to many people and still do. Single-sex communities, team-based right livelihoods, cooperatives, Dharma teaching centers, conventions, gatherings. We've inherited a whole series of forms that give life to those principles. And each generation of order members and Sangha members are inheritors of these principles. And we will have to sustain the forms. We will have to develop new forms. And we will have to find ways of making our livings and support to practice the Dharma. We will have to find means and ways of practicing like our hair is on fire. And we have to find means and ways of getting to know each other. And that is what we have to do. And in a way, this is what I like. This is what I want to do. This is what I want to do. I think that, you know, the kind of questioning about what it means to save the world. The answer is not a concept. The answer is a way of living. The answer is a gathering of all one's energies behind what you do in a way that's actually just quite simple and uncomplicated. And this is what I want to do. It's what I want to do for the rest of my life, actually. So how are we going to do that? How are we going to make intense enough situations? How are we going to create situations of depth and breadth to support our practice? And I'm not going to give you an answer to that because it's not my answer to give, but I want to give you the question. What do you want to do that will make a difference? That's the question I want to give you. What do you want to do that makes a difference individually? What do you want to do that makes a difference collectively? So let's work that out, and then we can go on an adventure together. We can go on an adventure while we're working it out. You can start now. And I want to start with the preliminary admonition. I'm just going to read it out from the Ratnaguna Samchayagata. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the wheel of the world, for heroic spirits intended. Call forth as much as you can of love, of faith, and of respect. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Thank you.